Yes, Dick Tong from ETH presenting his work on network on locality and large linear programs. Victor will be here visiting for this week and next week and maybe a third week.
Yeah,
yes. So.
Hi, thank you for having me here. And I'm here to tell you about some ongoing work I have on network on locality. Wait, is the mic on?
I think it is, yeah.
Can you hear me?
Is the green light on?
No, it's on, yeah. Hello? Test.
Calling purposes, maybe it doesn't
come. Okay, it doesn't come here, okay. So yeah, so this is a sort of a progress report more than the final output of this work, let's say. I'm still like in the middle of making progress on this project. So I thought I could tell you about the problem I'm trying to solve and like the techniques I'm using, which hopefully are maybe useful for some of you too. So in the first part, we'll talk about non-locality and the non-locality problem I'm looking at. And then we'll go over the techniques I'm using in part two, and then part three, we'll look over some of the current results I have. So first, let's start with causality. So causality is concerned with looking at causal graphs. So I'm using a notation where these square nodes correspond to classical observed variables, whereas the green circle ones are classical latent variables, and the arrows denote causal connections, right? So before quantum mechanics, of course, causal modeling was concerned with all sorts of graphs of this form with observed and unobserved variables, but all of them being classical. Now we have quantum theory, obviously. So we also have some quantum causal models where some of the nodes can be quantum. So here I have some quantum latent variables. And of course, we can mix and match, so we can have both, you know, classical and quantum in the same graph. And so what this means here, for instance, is that Bob is measuring, is doing like a joint measurement on the half of rho that he gets and the half of sigma that he gets, right? So let's say causal modeling is concerned with investigating what type of causal model can give rise to what type of correlations, right? And in particular, I'm interested in comparing how quantum theory and classical theory can behave in this context. And this is what non-locality is about. So we are comparing graphs that have some, we're comparing whether like classical and quantum can be different for a given graph. So the idea is we should first fix a graph, and then we just change whether or not the latent variables are quantum or classical. Right? So the prime example of that is the Bell scenario, which looks like that in my notation. So we have Alice and Bob receiving inputs x and y, and they either share a classical random variable or a quantum state. And obviously, the Bell scenario is very important. So there is a difference between these two scenarios, right? There are correlations that you can do on the right-hand side that you cannot do on the left-hand side, which has many, many applications, including in quantum cryptography, in quantum complexity theory, and others. Hey. It's very important. But for the purpose of this project, we consider them as being relatively simple scenarios, both computationally and we think we understand very well. And so we want to go to the next easiest thing, which is, so you can do multipartite Bell scenarios, right, where you have, for instance, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, but they all have access to the same either classical random variable or quantum state. That's still relatively easy. So the next easiest thing is to look at cases where you have at least two independent latent variables. And perhaps one of the simplest examples of that is the triangle network. The triangle network like that. So I apologize to all those that are used to seeing it as an equilateral triangle. I know this is a big thing, but this notation will be useful for what comes later because it lets us put things on a grid somehow, which is a bit nicer to represent. So on the left, we have the classical triangle network where Alice, Bob, and Charlie share, so each pair of parties share a classical random variable. On the right, they share a quantum state. The correlations, there are no inputs here, right? Although you can add inputs if you want, but here I consider a triangle network without inputs. And so on the left, we can define the correlations, the classical correlations that we can do in this scenario, which we call the local correlations. And these are the probabilities P of A, B, and C that can be written as the average over alpha, beta, and gamma, the sources that the source gives. I take the sources to be uniformly distributed between 0 and 1 without loss of generality. So yeah, the average of the product of some response functions for Alice, Bob, and Charlie where Alice outputs a little a given beta and gamma, and similarly for Bob and Charlie. Right. The quantum set, on the other hand, consists of the distributions P of A, B, and C that can be written using the Born rule as this sort of expression. So for each source, so like for alpha, we have a state rho of alpha left, alpha right, because alpha is like a bipartite state, similarly for beta and gamma. And then Alice, for instance, performs a measurement on beta left and gamma right and outputs the outcome little a. So that's the quantum set. And well, there is a difference between these two scenarios again. In particular, here there are no inputs, so we can have non-locality without inputs. So you can have non-locality without assuming this freedom of choice assumption that appears in the Bell theorem, right? So this is what this paper describes. Of course, you have to trade the freedom of choice assumption in favor of another assumption, which is that the sources that you assume that are independent are indeed independent, right? So it's not, you don't totally give up freedom of choice, you sort of replace it by a different flavor of assumption somehow. So this is very important. This paper here was concerned with a distribution that sort of came from embedding a Bell scenario inside of the triangle scenario. In particular, only one of the two sources that they consider was quantum and the other two were classical. But you can also have non-locality in triangle network with all sources being quantum. This paper is an example of that. So it's called genuine quantum non-locality because the non-locality cannot really be traced back to Bell non-locality, mostly. I should say that although the above is concerned with a distribution that comes from the Bell scenario, the techniques that were used to prove the non-locality are still distinct from those typically used in Bell non-locality to account for the triangle network. All the paper above was experimentally friendly because they could do an experiment. The one below here is not, we don't really have a proof that is sort of a proof of non-locality that is robust to noise. So one driving question for this project is, can we get noise robust, genuine triangle non-locality? That's something we don't really have. And more generally, the overall problem is, can we find some generic techniques that are generically good to prove non-locality in networks, right? That's sort of the thing we want to do. And an example of a distribution which motivates this project is the Elegant Joint Measurement, which was introduced by Nicolas Gisin in 2017. And this distribution is believed to be non-local, but we don't have a proof for that. And so that sort of, motivates us to develop some new techniques. In fact, this is the problem I started my PhD on, and so it's been challenging me since then, and I'm still not there, although I'm getting closer. So this distribution is, I denoted P EGM. So this distribution, the probability that all parties output the same outcome is given by 25 over 256. The probability that two outcomes agree and one disagrees is 1 over 256, and the probability that the three parties get distinct outcome is 5 over 256. So this distribution is quite symmetric, right? You can exchange the parties, you can relabel the outcomes, it doesn't really change anything. And so this distribution is in the quantum set, so we can do that distribution in the triangle network using qubits, actually, using singlet states and entangled measurements. And there are strong indications that this distribution is not local, even if you add noise to the states and the measurements that you can use to produce the distribution. But we don't have a proof, right? So can we prove that it's non-local? And even better, can we prove that it's non-local even with some noise, right? That would be like the best somehow. So the technique we'll use for or proofs of non-locality is inflation, right? So this is a very useful technique. Inflation gives outer approximations of network correlations. So it's a relaxation of the membership problem to the respective set of correlation. It exists for classical and non-singling networks. For classical and non-singling networks, one gets a linear program relaxation. The difference between classical and non-singling networks lies in the type of inflation graphs that we consider, basically whether or not we allow to clone information, because of course for quantum and non-signaling, we cannot clone information for free. Inflation also exists for quantum networks, in which case one gets a semi-definite program relaxation, but okay, we don't really talk about that in this presentation. And I would argue that it's the best technique we have for proofs of non-locality in networks. At least that's one of the things I'm trying to show, I guess. In fact, inflation for classical networks converges to the set of classical correlations of to the local set for arbitrary large inflation graphs. So that's like a proof of principle that it's really a good method that really captures locality. So how does inflation work? One first picks an inflation graph. You look at it. You look at its properties. And then based on that, you can formulate a relaxation. So let's go over how that works exactly. So first, we have to pick an inflation graph. So here's the 2-2-2 inflation graph, where we use two copies of the alpha source, two copies of the beta source, and two copies of the gamma source. So here by copy, I mean no matter where the alpha source came from, you can just order like a second one and place it in that arrangement, and similarly for the others. And then for each source, so here the gamma source, for instance, had two outputs in the original triangle scenario. But because it's classical information, we can just like clone the values that the gamma source produced and fan out, in that sense, the source to get four outgoing edges instead of two. And then we connect players to like all the pairs of inputs that make sense. So we have four Alices, one Alice for each pair of source that she can connect to. Right? So what are some properties of that graph, which will be useful for the relaxation we'll formulate in a minute? First, notice that if you remove the off-diagonal parties, you evidently get two like independent instances of the original triangle network, right? That will be important. You have like one triangle here and one here, right? And there's no like parent node in common. Another property is the symmetry that this graph has. So we see that if we exchange the two alpha sources and correspondingly exchange the, the rows of parties connected to it, this is sort of an automorphism of the inflation graph. So it's sort of a symmetry that it has. And we have similar symmetries if you exchange the two beta sources and the two gamma sources. Right. So these are the two properties I want you to remember for this graph. If we marginalize over some of the agents, we get two copies of the initial scenario, and there are some symmetries. Right. Now we can look at bigger inflations. Here's the 2-2-3 inflation, where we have duplicated three times the gamma source. We can look at the 2-2-4 inflation. Yes. So this is the largest one I've considered so far for the elegant jet measurement. We can also look at the 2-3-3. So this time we have two alphas, three betas, three gammas, so nine Alices. And this is the largest inflation that was considered for the shared random bit that has two outputs, which will come back at the end of the presentation. So yeah, there are all these graphs. But how do we actually formulate the relaxation? So here's how the logic works. So assume that the target distribution P is local. Then there exist response functions for Alice, Bob, and Charlie, such that the distribution is the appropriate average of product of response functions. Right? That implies that we can construct a distribution Q, which I would call the honest inflation distribution, that is a distribution over the outcomes of the parties of the previous 2-2-2 inflation graph. Right? So it involves 12 parties. And I represent here on the left-hand side the probability, according to this distribution Q, that Charlie 1-1 outputs the outcome little C11, Charlie 1-2 outputs the outcome little C12, etc. And that we define by, again, an average over a product of response function. So we average over gamma 1, gamma 2, beta 1, beta 2, gamma, sorry, alpha 1. Yeah, you got it, right? All the six sources that appear in the graph, we average that. So we average the product of response functions. These are the response functions that we assumed give rise to P in the original triangle network, right? Like, we don't know what these are, right, in general. But if we assume that P is local, these exist, and we can use them to construct the honest distribution Q like that. And this distribution Q has some properties that we can basically read off the inflation graph. And based on these properties, we can construct a relaxed Q. So it's an inflation distribution which is only required to satisfy some loose constraints, let's say, that the honest Q satisfy. But we don't impose that the relaxed Q comes from an average of product of response functions, right? We just assume that Q should only satisfy these constraints. So the first constraint is the marginal constraint that I was describing at first. So if you marginalize over the off-diagonal parties, which is what I meant here, you get two independent copies of your original distribution. And the symmetries of the inflation graph give rise to some symmetries of the distribution. So here, this symmetry that I depicted here corresponds to the symmetry under the exchange of the two alpha sources, right? And et cetera, because you have all the other symmetries. Yes?
Sorry, just to see if I'm understanding correctly, Q is a distribution in the inflation graph.
Yeah, so both Q honest and Q relax are distribution on the inflation graph.
Right, and so, then Q honest would be a distribution that is like classically compatible with the inflation graph.
Yes.
And Q relaxed does not, is not classically compatible necessarily, but it'll be some of the constraints.
Exactly. Yes.
Not all of them. So when you go back to the original graph, you're going to obtain some of the constraints that inflation can give you, but not all.
Yes. Well, that depends on how you define all of them. Like, if you define all the constraints to mean that really this should be the expression, then clearly, like, no matter like the type of linear relaxation you get, you will not capture this sort of nonlinear type equation. Yeah. Does that?
Okay. Yeah, makes sense. Thanks.
Okay. So does this make sense so far? Because like the rest is built on that. So like. Okay, we can always come back to it. So. To summarize, if the target distribution P is local, there exists this inflation distribution Q, which satisfies this property, and we care about the contrapositive of that statement, which is if there does not exist such a distribution Q, then the distribution P cannot be local, right? So that's how we will prove non-locality. We'll prove that there does not exist an inflation distribution, and then we can conclude about the non-locality of the distribution, right? Let's reformulate the problem a little bit so that it becomes easier to formulate some algorithm that solves the problem. So just abstracting away a bit what we had before. So the problem we care about is whether or not there exists a distribution Q on the inflation graph, which has to be, of course, non-negative and normalized, such that certain marginals of Q are equal to a product of the target distribution, right? So here M is like a matrix that somehow takes as input Q and gives as output the marginal of Q on the appropriate set of parties. So that's the marginal constraint. And then we have the symmetry constraint. So we have a certain symmetry group corresponding to the action of the sources. And when that symmetry group, so we equip the symmetry group with an action, like a linear action on the inflation distribution, and the distribution Q should be invariant under that symmetry action. So the first step is to remove or to reformulate the symmetry condition. So instead of saying that Q has to be symmetric and has to have the right marginal, we will just say that there should exist a Q, which doesn't need to be symmetric, but then we twirl over the symmetries to get a symmetric one, right? So here, Q no longer has to be symmetric. We take an arbitrary Q, we symmetrize it, and then that symmetrized distribution should have the right marginals. Right? One can show that the two are equivalent. And so here, G is like, so it's a linear map. It's the G twirl over the symmetries. And it consists of averaging over all the symmetries that the group has. And then, so now Q is just a distribution, right? So it lives in like a high-dimensional simplex. So any distribution Q can be expressed as a convex combination of deterministic behaviors. So we can express the same problem as whether or not the target distribution squared can be expressed as a convex combination of M applied after G on some deterministic inflation distribution. So here we're using the linearity of M and G to take the convex mixture outside. And so Q dot E is the inflation distribution which deterministically outputs outcomes according to an event E. So a little E is an inflation event. It looks like some sort of grid like that, kind of like a Sudoku, right? And the set of all events I call curly E. So that's the problem we have. We want to look at whether or not this sort of target point, P squared, lives in a polytope whose extremal points we know. Notice that in this talk, I will use the term extremal points in an incorrect or loose sense. I don't mean necessarily extremal points. So here, all the points generated by all the E's don't have to be extremal points, right? Some could be like in the middle of the polytope, but I still call them extremal points for what I hope is simplicity.
Sorry, I missed what is G for every...
Right, that's a good question. So G. So there is one G associated to this symmetry. So the G associated to that symmetry, if you think of Q as a big column vector, right? Each entry corresponds to like one probability of one event. And here this says that some components of Q are equal to some other components of Q, right? And so G is just a permutation matrix which takes Q, exchanges the components according to the symmetry, and then we'd say that before, after symmetry, the vector has to be the same. Right? So G is just like capturing that kind of constraint.
you say that you're using extreme points loosely?
Yeah.
Are you sort of just putting a caveat, or do you know this is a fact that it's possible to find a deterministic strategy when you sort of symmetrize it, it is no longer extreme?
I would expect that at least for large inflations, there exists a deterministic event that yields a symmetrized inflation distribution, which is not extremal. Namely, if you take like an inflation sufficiently large such that you basically have the local set again, and you take sort of a maximally mixed strategy, I would expect that that gives a non-extremal point. But I'm not sure. But it doesn't matter. It's just like, I'm saying I don't have a, yeah, we don't, yeah. It's more like a caveat in the terminology, let's say. But I'm not sure. But it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Why are you not imposing like the two marginals of injective steps in the inflation graph and in the original graph are not the same? Are you imposing that somehow with these constraints?
So you mean, am I imposing that if you only keep A11, B11, C11, you get A11, B11, like that?
Yes.
That is implied by this one, right? So like if you take this constraint and you marginalize over A22, B22, C22, you get another constraint, which may be the one you describe, or maybe not.
If, can you go to the inflation?
The graph?
Yeah. Here, for example, if you look at, let's say, C12 and B11, that C12. Marginal should
yeah.
be equal to the... to
yes.
the marginal of C and B in the triangle,
yes.
right?
That is a good point. So this is actually implied. So okay. So in general, yeah, here I don't claim I have listed all the constraints. Actually, there is one that I miss. But the one you describe actually is already contained. But like in general, to be safe, one should include like all the constraints somehow, right? But here I'm using the fact that I've sort of played around with this constraint and I know which one implies which one. And the one you describe is actually implied by the one I've listed. To see that, you sort of first take this constraint,
mm-hmm.
you marginalize over like everyone except C11, B11, you get the marginal of C11, B11 should be the original P of BC. And then, but you were describing the one where you had C21 or C12, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this one you get also automatically because of the symmetry under the exchange of the two beta.
I see, okay.
But yeah, good. In general, one should be careful to put as many constraints as possible, yeah.
I see.
So the one I miss specifically is yeah, okay, I'm not sure I can see it, but basically there's like a marginal of this, which gives like P of A times P of B times P of C, like so a third order constraint in some sense. So this is not included in the one I described, but you can of course add it, right? Just for simplicity of presentation, I included like the main one. Yeah. Right, okay, so that's where we left, right? So we want to check whether or not a target point lives in a convex hull. And so we can just abstract that away a bit, and we say, so X is just like P tensor P. I call it the target point, right? So it's not the target distribution. It's like the tensor product of the target distribution with itself. We want to check whether that point lives in the convex hull whose extremal points we know, and they are indexed by inflation events E. And in the case where the target point is in the convex hull, then that means there exists an inflation distribution, so the test of non-locality is inconclusive. Whereas if that does not, the target point is outside of the polytope, then there does not exist an inflation distribution, and so the target distribution has to be non-local, right? So let's call the number of dimensions in which the vectors x and ye live, let's call that n. So we have n dimensions, and let's call the size of the set of all events to be m, so we have m extremal points. Let's give some numbers. For the previous 2-2-2 problem I was describing, we have that the number of dimensions, that's the number of like scalar constraints we have, was, so because we had P tensored P with four outcomes per party for the elegant joint measurement. So here I'm assuming four outcomes per party. We had 4^6, so 4,000 roughly constraints or dimensions. And the number of extremal points is, well, how many events we have. And in that case, we have 12 parties, four outcome each. So a total of 4^12 events. So that's 16 million. Events, which is medium size, let's say. It's large, but not too large. Whereas if we look at the 2-2-2, so this is like the numbers are like the largest problem I've considered so far. we had 400,000 dimensions and 10 to the 12 extremal points. Now that's a bit big. So this is where we need to, yeah, how do we deal with that, right? In particular here, I claim that you cannot put this problem in a standard commercial LP solver because it's too big. However, the problem has more structure than like a random linear program. So like a random linear program would be like you pick like a random matrix somehow and then, but here it's like really like a polytope membership problem and we know the extremal points which have some structure. So there is the hope that we can do a better algorithm than just turning to a commercial LP solver. LP is linear program, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can you maybe go back? How do you get these extremal points?
Yes. So y sub e corresponds to m applied after g on q det sub e. So you take an inflation event, e, you look at the deterministic inflation distribution it gives. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a vector with like 1, 1 and all zeros, if you look at it as a column vector. Then you twirl over the inflation symmetries that you have. That's a linear operation. Then you apply the map that extracts the marginal of your inflation distribution. So that M depends basically on which constraint you impose. So if here you had more constraints, if you had some other like injectable set that was equal to some other product of the original distribution, the matrix M would actually be like a direct sum of two small matrices.
So you only looked at one injectable set, which is like A1, B1, C1, and A2, B2, C2.
So here I'm looking at one injectable set, one constraint. But actually, even if you had more, you could still put this in the same form, except, okay, what you would have would be, so suppose you had like M1 of Q equals like some sort of P1, some product of the original distribution, and you had M2 of Q equals some P2. Then you could take like the direct sum, and you would have that sort of M1 direct sum with M2 that defines a new matrix M, and then P1 direct sum with P2 that defines like a new target point. And the formulation still applies. So I'm claiming that this formulation is sort of general, but I've described in details, or some details, a version with only one constraint.
So if you did that, like with all of the injectable sets,
mm-hmm.
you would be able to obtain everything that in principle could be obtained from this inflation.
Right. This is really equivalent. Yeah, I'm not
obtaining everything because you're only looking at one.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. Yes, so here for, yeah. Presentation purposes, I'm looking at a simple inflation problem, but I'm claiming that all of them can be put in that form. At least, yeah. I mean, yeah, all the linear ones, right? I mean, of course, if you include like non-linear constraints in Q, then that changes the story a lot. But yeah, all inflation linear problems can be rephrased like that. Okay, so how do we deal with that? Yeah, that's the second part. How do we solve large linear programs? The first thing we need to do is to reduce the size of the problem using symmetry. That's really like the easiest simplification we can make, which drastically improves our chances to prove anything. So this slide is a bit short. I try to briefly summarize how symmetry reduction works in this case. There are two types of symmetries. The first is column symmetry, or equivalently, extremal point symmetry. The idea is that if you can find a group, G columns, such that the points YE indexed by the event E, if you apply an element of that group on E, you get the same vector, right, the same column. That basically means that you have your set of all YE. You basically have duplicate labels, right? You have like the same point, which is labeled like many times, potentially by different events. So they are seemingly different looking extremal points, but actually they are the same, right? So if you have that, which you can find, then we can quotient the set of all events, all inflation events, by the group of symmetry. And in doing so, so what that means is that we look at all events, we take the orbits under the symmetry group that we have. For each orbit, we pick one representative and we discard all the other events. That's quotienting. And then the size of the quotient set of events, the symmetrized events, I call it M tilde instead of M, and it's roughly on the order of M divided by the number of symmetries one has. There is a similar thing for the rows or for the dimensions. We can find a group G row such that, so the YE and the X is a vector, right? Which comes with an index I that labels the components. And if we can find a group such that the x components are sort of invariant and they're applying any transformation of that symmetry group, and similarly for all the YE. If we have that, then we basically have that some dimensions are like equivalent, right? You just like everything is the same along two dimensions, so you can just project out one of the dimensions for free. It doesn't change the problem, and that reduces the number of dimensions you have to deal with, right? So I'm claiming you can find such a group, and then you can quotient the indices that label your dimensions, your components. You can quotient that again, and you get this time n tilde many symmetrized dimensions. And n tilde is on the order of n divided by the number of symmetries of that group. So let's put some numbers to that. So for the, one thing is that the symmetry groups, actually you can exploit the symmetries of the target distribution to have larger symmetry groups here. I don't describe how, but okay. You can do that. And so actually here, the numbers I give actually depend on the symmetries of the target distribution. So specifically for the elegant jot measurement, for the 2-2-2 problem we had before, so these are the same numbers as the previous slide, 4,000 dimensions, that goes to only 33 dimensions after the symmetry reduction, and we go from 16 million to only 15,000 extremal points. So that's quite a massive improvement, right? What about the larger one? So for the 2-2-4 case, we had 400,000 dimensions. After symmetrization, we get 4,000. And we go from 10 to the 12 extremal points to only 10 to the 8, which again is quite valuable. And this is like for free, right? So here the takeaway message is always exploit the symmetries of your problem, because that's like very fairly easy to do. There's a bit of bookkeeping, obviously, but like it's fairly easy to do and you get like a massive improvement. Now, how do we actually solve? Sorry, other questions on that maybe before I?
You're accounting for not just the symmetry of the sort of native inflation group.
Yes.
But any symmetry which works with your extremal points and the distribution.
Yes, yes. So, so here, okay, there are some details which are left under the hood, but if you want, so like for simplicity, you can think of these groups, G column and G row, as some sort of like reduced symmetry group that is generated by the symmetries of the inflation graph and the exchange of the sources. That's like the base. On top of that, you can exploit further symmetries, which I don't describe here, but you can do it. Which matters a lot. it helps a lot.
Do you know you found all the symmetries there are, or could there be ones you missed?
I certainly don't have like a proof of the, I don't have a statement of the form for this problem. I don't have a proof that I have all the symmetries.
Okay.
But I believe I have all of them, which is not a proof.
Okay. Maybe when you get a solution after crunching the numbers, can you see maybe you, in retrospect you missed some symmetries? Or is that like really?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you do that. Yeah. But yeah, I guess it would be good at some point for me to sit down and check whether I haven't missed any. That's probably a good thing I should do. Yeah. All right. So now, how do we solve the polytope membership problem? The first step is to understand very well separating hyperplanes, because that's really the key, let's say. So separating hyperplanes, the idea is that if you have a point which is outside of a polytope, you can find a plane that sort of separates the two, right? Visually, I guess it's relatively clear. So let's do an example of that. So here I have my extremal points, I pick 5 of them, and I put the target point x just a tiny bit outside of their convex hull, right? So how can we, suppose we're sort of, you know, in the dark, we cannot really see, because now we see it outside, right, obviously, but like suppose you cannot see because there are many dimensions and you don't see everything at once, what can you do? Well, you can pick a direction, which I call T. I will call the direction T a hyperplane, so T is not a hyperplane, T is the normal vector to a hyperplane, but for simplicity, I call T also a hyperplane sometimes. Maybe hyperplane direction would be more precise. Anyway, so, okay, you pick a T, and you check, is that a separating hyperplane or not? What that means is you check for the, you minimize the inner product of T with all the extremal points of your set, and you check whether you can achieve a better score. So because you're minimizing, better means smaller, if you can achieve, or lower. If you can achieve a lower score with some extremal points compared to what you can achieve with the target point, that means T is not a separating hyperplane. So in this case, we picked a bad T, too bad. Now let's pick a good T. We take T, obviously upwards, and then if we minimize over all the inner products, this time we see that the target point achieves a lower score, so a better score, than the best extremal point we can find. And that certifies, I mean, that means that T is the normal vector to a separating hyperplane. So we have, yeah, the minimum over all extremal points of T dot that vector is strictly greater than what the target point does. And then we can, yeah, certify that the target point is outside of the polytope, and so we have a non-local target distribution. Because again, this implies that there is no inflation distribution, and so it cannot be local. Now let's look a bit at what happens if this time the target point was inside of the convex hull. So I place it a tiny bit inside. So if we pick the same direction going to the right, we see that, again, it's not a separating hyperplane because we can do a better score than the target point. If we pick the upwards direction, again, we see that we can do a better score than the target point. And you can convince yourself that no matter how you like orient your T, there will always be an extremal point that does better than what the target point does. So in this case, if X is inside of the convex hull, for all directions T, T will not be a separating hyperplane, and so we cannot conclude anything, right? Actually, if we could certify that for all T this holds, then we would know that the point is inside, right? But yeah. And so, okay, so that's the basic idea, right? What is nice about the separating hyperplane business is that, so remember, we have many extremal points, right? And so with the separating hyperplane business, we don't have to hold them all in memory. The only part, so we just like pick a random T, and then we can minimize over all the extremal points. So that's the part where we have to sort of think about all extremal points. But I'm claiming that you can minimize sort of minimization here. I will call it the linear minimization oracle in the following slides. I'm claiming that this you can do relatively efficiently compared to holding all points in memory. So that's sort of the strength of this approach. What is now the, what should be the big question is how do you pick these directions T? So a brute force algorithm would be you randomly sample a direction and you check and you hope to find a separating hyperplane, and if it doesn't work after, you know, a year, you give up, right? That's obviously not very good. I tried that initially to see how it worked, but obviously, like, when you have many dimensions and your point is somewhat close to your polytope, there's no chance that you will find the sweet spot which separates the target point from the polytope. So we have to do something better, and this is where the big player of this presentation comes in, Frank Wolf. So this is an algorithm, the Frank Wolf algorithm, which is very nice. Basically, it lets you, in short, it lets you pick these directions T, right? That's what it does. So a few words about the algorithm in general. So this is an iterative algorithm for constrained convex optimization. So it's an algorithm of the form where you sort of walk towards the optimal point. And it's a projection-free algorithm. So sometimes for constrained convex optimization, what you do is you sort of, yeah, walk towards your optimal solution. But in doing that, sometimes you will go out of your manifold of constraints and you will have to project back your iterate to the manifold of constraints. Frank Wolf is projection-free. There are no such projections. And sometimes the projections are costly. So that's the strength of Frank Wolf. Right. So it was proposed by Margaret Frank and Philip Wolf in 1956. No family relation, I believe, Eddie. And it exists in various flavors. There is the vanilla Frank Wolf, also known as the Gilbert algorithm. There is the pairwise Frank Wolf, the away step Frank Wolf. There exists also the my favorite one, the lazy blended pairwise conditional gradient Frank Wolf, which is quite nice. And there's also the fully corrective Frank Wolf, which is the one I will describe. So I will describe a bit how they vary, but basically they are sort of very similar in spirit, and the devil hides in the details. And I recommend this great. So Frank Wolf is also like the Frank Wolf algorithm and the conditional gradient method or algorithm are sort of synonyms, right? So there is this good review if you want to learn about that. Each sort of variant have, I mean, some are bad, like the vanilla is sort of bad universally, but like all the others maybe have some, you know, are maybe good in some situations and bad in some others. And the Frank Wolf algorithm has already been successfully applied to Bell non-locality, right? So in some sense, we want to take those tools and apply them to network non-locality. Okay, so now for the animated slide. So here I will display how it works, and then we'll sort of summarize as an algorithm. But first, let's do like a sort of a visualization of how it works. So remember, we don't want to store all the vertices in memory. That would be too costly, right? So we can start by just storing one in memory. And I will call the active set the set of extremal points that we actually store in memory. So here the shaded points are those we store in memory, and the others are like there in the background. they can be accessed when we minimize over all inner products, but we don't like sort of explicitly store them in memory. So imagine you're in charge of picking a separating hyperplane. You only know this red cross and this point. What is the best potential separating hyperplane you would pick? I hope you would pick this one, right? You join the target point to the point you know. Okay, so you pick this T, right? Is it good? Well, we check. No, it's not good. There is actually an extremal point that achieves a better score. All right. But this time, instead of like throwing that away, when we were doing like the random sampling of T, we keep that in memory. So now our active set contains two extremal points. Now we repeat. Given these two active points, what is the best potential separating hyperplane? Well, we can draw the line segment between the two points. We can minimize the distance between the target point and that line segment. And then we pick our direction T to be that direction, right? This looks like a good guess. All right, so is T a separating hyperplane? No, there is this vertex that achieves a better score. We store it in memory. Now we look at the convex hull of the three points we have in memory. It looks like that. Again, we minimize the distance between the target point and that convex hull. We get this point. We choose T to be this small vector over there. And now we do have a separating hyperplane, right? So we successfully found a separating hyperplane in three iterations in that sense. And we only ended up storing three points in memory out of the five. Okay, so in this case, the difference is very small, but in practice, this is a huge difference. Okay, so that's how it works when the point happens to be outside. Let's repeat, sorry. So yeah, so the point is outside, so in that case, we conclude non-local, right? Let's repeat the procedure when the point is inside. Again, we start with the same initial vertex in the active set. We pick the direction T like that. Is that a separating hyperplane? No, there is this vertex. We store it in memory. We draw the line segment. We minimize the distance between the line segment and target point. We pick a new T. Is that a separating hyperplane? No, there is this vertex. We store it in memory. We look at the convex hull of the three points. And this time, we minimize the distance between the target point and that polytope. We find zero, right? The target point is actually inside that polytope. So now we can stop the algorithm and conclude, actually, the point is inside the polytope, right? Because it's inside the small polytope, so it's also inside the bigger one, right? And in that case, the test of non-locality is inconclusive. Yeah. Do you want to see it again, or is that clear? Cool. So let's summarize this as an actual algorithm. So we need the linear minimization oracle, which is this procedure that takes the direction T and returns the minimum overlap between T and any vertex, as well as the optimizer. So here, the event associated to a Y that actually minimizes this overlap. And then we can formulate the fully corrective Frank-Wolf algorithm. So initially, we need to pick, so curly S will be the active set. And initially, we pick some arbitrary initial extremal point for our active set. You can put more if you want. You can pick three or whatever, but it should be small somehow. You don't want to put all of them inside, otherwise you're sort of back to basically like calling like a LP solver on the whole problem somehow. So you want to keep this initial set small. I typically just choose one point. And then we repeat the following steps. So we minimize the distance between X and the convex hull of our active set. Okay, initially there's only one point, so this is trivial, but okay. The optimizer is S star, and we pick the direction T to be S star minus X, as we were doing in the previous slide. We query the linear minimization oracle for that direction. We get the overlap alpha and the event E that achieves that minimum. And then we compare the overlap alpha to the score of the target point. And if the target point scores a better score than alpha, then we have a separating hyperplane, and so we can return non-local. Yeah. In fact, here we can also return T, because T is then like a certificate, like a dual certificate of the infeasibility of the linear program. Yeah. Otherwise, if T is not a separating hyperplane, we add the new point we discovered to the active set, and we repeat, and we repeat, and we repeat. At some point, we will find a separating hyperplane if the target point is outside. If it's inside, we will just at some point find that this distance, this minimum distance here, will just be like zero, or at least very small. And so here, this condition is just saying, yeah, if the distance of this minimization is very small, then some epsilon, we exit the loop and we return inconclusive, right? So that's the algorithm. And so the difference between the fully corrective Frank-Wolf and the other variants are basically in how you keep track of this active set, right? So here I'm minimizing this Euclidean distance. And but there are like other strategies one can employ, and that gives rise to like the variance. But like all of them share this structure of like guess somehow a separating hyperplane, and then make use of the, and either it's separating or not, and if it's not separating hyperplane, you just keep track of the output to improve your guess somehow. That's like the general spirit. And what's nice is that in doing that, so the only part where we see all the external points is in the linear minimization oracle, because otherwise the set S grows relatively little. In fact, in practice, we end up storing on the order of n points. So n is the number of dimensions, right? So remember, think like a 1,000 dimensions and, you know, 10 to the 9 extremal points. So it's a massive improvement if we only store these in memory somehow. And yeah, only the linear minimization oracle sees all the extremal points. So that's the algorithm. Now, the last part is to say a few words about how the linear minimization oracle works. Yeah. we need to minimize the inner. So we are given a vector t. We need to minimize the inner product between t and the ye, right? So we want to somehow iterate over all the events. And in fact, we can use a tree search over the events, because the events are basically like a Sudoku grid that you're filling. And so we can start filling it by saying, so here I'm doing like two outcomes per party for so that it fits. So we can fill the outcome of Charlie 1-1 to be either 0 or 1. Then Charlie 1-2 can have 0 or 1, etc. We get a whole tree. And so naively, what you can, or naively, you can just like iterate over all the leaves of that tree to minimize your distance. That sort of works, but you can do better than that. The tree search allows for some optimizations. How am I doing on time? Okay, I guess I should maybe skip some stuff, but like, as I've said, the events, we can symmetrize them, we can quotient them with respect to some symmetry group. But the tree search allows for something which is quite nice, which is that suppose you have like 10 to the 12 events and you want to symmetrize them, and you do it, you have to like iterate over all of them somehow, right? You have to do at least 10 to the 12 steps if you don't do it with a tree search. Whereas with the tree search, the problem has enough structure so that we can start symmetrizing early on, like early up in the tree somehow. For instance, here, if we can say that these two are symmetrically related, which is sometimes the case, we can already at this depth get rid of half of the tree in like one step, which is like a massive improvement. And we can continue. So as we go down the tree, we cut the branches as soon as possible based on symmetry. That's quite nice. Other than that, we can parallelize, of course, the computing this minimum, right? So we can give like half of the tree to one thread, the other half to another thread. They each compute their local minima. We take the two results, we output the global minimum of the two, right? Easy. And we can use branch and bound. So this is maybe the most advanced one that I, yeah, again, don't really present here in details, but basically what we can do is, so suppose we have found some current minimum. So we know that like somewhere at some point we achieve a certain score, right? And so the global minimum will be for sure less than that, less than or equal than that. And suppose we are investigating a new branch, we're like halfway down the tree, and we have some means of saying, for sure, given I know T, I know like the partial filling of my event, I know there's no way this is gonna score good. I can discard the whole branch, right? That's like branch and bound. And there are various ways, especially in this context, of doing branch and bound, so there's a trade-off, right? How much time are you willing to invest in computing some bounds versus how much of the tree these bounds allow to get rid of? So then, okay, one can play and find something that makes sense. Yeah. So that's like how I do it. I mean, how I'm planning to do it. There are some parts which are not fully implemented yet, but okay. And that's, sorry.
Symmetry reduction, which yeah. You're saying is distinct from branch and bound, just means that you discard points which ultimately would not be the canonical representatives in their orbit?
Yes. Okay. Exactly, yes. So the simplest one is suppose you have a global outcome symmetry. So suppose that like an event and the same event, but you permute 0 and 1 globally on all outcomes, suppose these two are always equivalent. Mm-hmm. Then already at the first step, you know that you can put without loss of probability a 0 for Charlie 1-1, and you can discard half of the tree, right? So that's not quite, I mean, maybe you can see it as branch and bound, but like it's, yeah, for me it's a different process, but yeah.
I would say it's kind of like your exploring over the quotient.
Yes, exactly. And so this early symmetry reduction business actually only happens once at the startup of the code somehow. You don't do it every time. You can do it once and then, well, assuming you have enough memory to store the tree. Also, the tree, what is nice is that you can actually compress it quite efficiently when stored in memory. So yeah, it's kind of nice. There are just many nice things one can do with trees. So yeah, save the trees. Good, so we can now talk about the applications. So there are not many applications, these are like the current, this is more like the current results I have, there are not that many. Hopefully I will, in the not too distant future, give again this talk with more results, but okay. So the first application is the shared random bit. So this is a nice distribution triangle network because it has only two outcomes per party. So it's computationally nice, like easy. And it was investigated already in the past, so I could compare, you know, my code to like the existing literature, which is of course important to check that what I'm doing makes sense. So the shared random bit for Alice, Bob, and Charlie consists of Alice, Bob, and Charlie all outputting 0 for probability 1/2 or all outputting 1 for probability 1/2, which is what this notation means. And the noisy shared random bit is a mixture of the shared random bit with a uniform, a maximally mixed distribution. So because you have two outcomes per party, that's the 1/8 distribution. And pretty clearly, when the visibility V is 100%, we have the shared random bit. That's in fact not even compatible with the non-signaling triangle network. So clearly it's non-local. Also clearly the 1/8 maximally mixed behavior is clearly local. So we know there will be some sort of transition point for the visibility where below that certain critical visibility, things are local and above that they are not. Right? So let's plot the range 33% to 40%. That's where the fun happens. So it has been shown that with local models, you can reach at least all the way to 36.21%. So that doesn't mean that, I mean, maybe you can go higher, right? But you can go at least there. And the best upper bound we had, sorry, yeah?
What do you call visibility?
So visibility is this V here, which is just like the mixing parameter in that decomposition. So yeah, it's just like for 100% visibility, V is equal to 1. So you have just the original distribution. And when V is 0, you have the maximally mixed distribution. And this is the name visibility, I think, comes from experimental quantum mechanics. So I don't know not a lot about that. But I believe that they're like, if they have like a singlet state or whatever, which has some white noise on it, they can decompose a singlet like some visibility V times the singlet plus 1 minus V times the maximally mixed state, and they call V the visibility. If you prefer, 1 minus V is like the noise, right? So the best upper bound we had on the critical visibility was this 37.72%, which was obtained using a 2-3-3 inflation. And this took about an hour to run. And using a 3-3-4 inflation in this work, we could prove that the upper bound is, the critical visibility is not above 36.63%. So it's like a real improvement. And on top of that, we could also check benchmark the code by comparing to the results of this other paper. And we could reproduce the results, which is of course very important. Up to, so one thing that you might notice here is the approximate symbols. So the code that I'm writing uses rational arithmetic, so I don't cover that here, but like you can do everything in rational arithmetic and then you get certificates of non-locality, which are like exact. Everything has like integers coefficients at the end. So here there is really no like floating point error. Right? Okay, cool. So now the elegant jet measurement. So let's pick a noise model, which is not super physical, but it's more like to have a toy model of noise that lets us see the improvements as we use larger inflations. So the noise models that follow, we define the P non-signaling. So this is kind of like a purified non-signaling version of the elegant jet measurement, which is, this is not quantum, I believe. Which consists of all Alice, Bob, and Charlie outputting. So here, there are 4 outcomes per party, right? Not 2. So Alice, Bob, and Charlie output the same outcome for probability 1/8, or they output 3 distinct outcomes with probability 1/48, right? And then we mix that distribution with the visibility parameter V again. We mix that with just like white noise. So 4 outcomes to the 3 is 1/64. So let's plot the full range, 0 to 100%. And the elegant jet measurement is here. So it's at exactly 3/4 for V. So lower bounds on the critical, and again, there is the same sort of behavior. For v equal to 0%, it's clearly local. For v equals 100%, it's clearly, well, not local. And there's like a unique transition. Yeah.
A question online.
Yeah.
From Pedro Lawant.
Uh-huh.
Okay. He's asking, is PNS compatible with NSI principles?
Yes, it is. Yes, so PNS is compatible with non-finite inflation. Yes. So a lower bound on the critical visibility is at least 3/7, which is about 42-43%. You can construct explicit local models that go all the way to there. And the best upper bound that I know of is this. So it's very frustratingly close, but not below the Elegant Jot measurement. So using a 2-4 inflation, we get down to this V star, and V star is about 75.7%. So a tiny bit above, which is a bit frustrating, but also gives a lot of hope that by adding, so this was using like the 2-4 inflation, but not all constraints. So in principle, there is hope that adding a few more constraints will get us down. And ideally, even like significantly, like at least like a few percent down the line, right?
If you get down the line, and that means that the Elegant
distribution is non-local. Exactly. Yes. Yes. So everything to the right of a red line means it has to be non-local. Everything to the left of a green bar means it's local, and everything below, between, we don't know. Right? And so so here this uncertainty is just like the grid. So like the way to sort of get these numbers is by doing a sort of a dichotomic search for visibility. And but at some point you have to, you know, stop. And so I use sort of this size of a grid. So the point is that V star with the plus sign was non-local, and V star with the minus sign was inconclusive. So the true V star of that inflation, if I were to repeat the computation with like a finer grid, would lie somewhere in that interval, which is between 75.6 and 75.8. But the point is that it's above, so I don't really care for the exact value, I guess. Okay, so the next steps are obviously to try to use either inflation level 233, which has only one more party than the 224, to prove the non-locality of the Elegant Jot measurement, or stay at 224 but with more constraints. Hopefully there is something like that works.
What are these more constraints?
I haven't used all the LPI constraints. So that means I haven't used like all the, you can think of this as I've only used like the sum of the marginals of the graph that corresponds to things I know. I've only used like part of them, like not all of them, some of them. And so I can just add more. And I should say, this took initially 11 days on the cluster I had access to. I'm working on getting that number down to maybe 1-2 days, and then crank up the inflation size again so that it doesn't take like 2 months to run, because, yeah. So try that. And then more generally, I mean, okay, the Elegant Jot measurement is nice and I like this problem, but more generally we could use this code and everything to look at non-locality in other scenarios, such as the bilocal network scenarios with inputs. That's also a fairly minimal scenario. I would like to look also at the classical triangle network when imposing identical causal mechanisms. That's also a scenario I'm interested in, because the Elegant Jot measurement is feasible in the quantum triangle network using the three times the same state and three times the same measurement. So there is a sense in which the right classical counterpart is not the classical triangle network with different response functions, but actually the same response function. I mean, that's something one can debate, I guess. But yeah, I'm generally interested in that. One thing one could try, for instance, is to improve the critical non-local visibility of the singlet state in some of these scenarios, right? So like, if you look at the singlet state in a Bell scenario with two inputs, two outputs, there is a certain level of noise it can tolerate before it becomes local. Okay, well, if you go to the bilocal scenario with, you know, two inputs, two outputs, something like that, can we improve using this method the visibilities one get? It's very easy to extend the framework here to a non-finite inflation, because like everything I've described, Frank Wolf, the tree search, the symmetries and everything, all that stays the same. The only difference is just like include more graphs. Like my code is sort of targeted at this type of inflation at the moment, but like, yeah, one could look at more graphs to look at the non-signaling networks, which is sort of interesting because these are like the ultimate limits to correlations in networks for any physical theories. More speculatively, can we somehow generalize the or apply the method to other type of polynomial optimization problems? Right. So here we have a polynomial optimization problem where we had like three, like the multiplication of the response functions of the three unknowns together. So it's like polynomial. So are there like other types of polynomial optimization problems that we can look at with more or less the same method? That would be nice. And also, yeah, there is some, I think, work to implement Frank Wolf for solving semi-definite programs. I don't know exactly the status of that branch of optimization, but like if we could apply that to quantum inflation semi-definite programs or other type of semi-definite programs that we have in quantum mechanics, that could also be cool. Yeah. So thank you.
You mentioned a variety of Frank Wolf algorithms, and you said you were summarizing the fully directed one.
Yeah.
What's sort of like the differences between them, or how is that different from the original?
Wait, let me scroll here. Ah, perfect. So in short, the difference is how do you manage your active set and how do you sort of minimize the distance. The vanilla Frank Wolf, for instance, mm-hmm. the way it works, maybe I should draw. I'll try to draw something. Oh, oops, sorry. Oh, well. The vanilla Frank Wolf, somehow your active set has size always at most 2 or 1, but like at most 2, right? Just keep track of fewer points. Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't have to draw, I guess. It's the same, except that when S, if S has already 2 elements, get rid of the oldest one and just put the new one, right? For instance, that's maybe the easiest modification one can do, right? And it performs very poorly. Yeah, so that's an example. And then there are more fancy ones which involve, so here I sort of keep track of all the points. I never discard points. That's why it's called fully corrective, because it includes all the corrections from all the points you've seen so far. But there are sort of in-betweens, let's say, in between the naive vanilla Frank Wolf and this one, which keeps track of everything, that selectively discard some points when they are sort of too far away and stuff like that, which can offer interesting trade-offs in some situations. As far as I've seen, this one is the best for the type of, you know, number of dimensions and number of extremal points that I was dealing with. I think because I have relatively few dimensions. I only have like 1,000 dimensions and not like a million. I think that makes the biggest difference somehow. Because the point is that here I'm using MoSec to solve that quadratic problem. And MoSec is very fast at solving like quadratic problem in like 1,000 dimensions. But I'm sure like if you go to a million, then it just like doesn't do anything useful. So then I guess you have to use one of these other variants, right? I suppose. Does it? Yeah?
There are 2 questions online.
Ah.
So Christian, you can go.
Okay, thank you for the nice talk. So my question is, if you can give some intuition about in which direction it's more interesting to go with inflation, like add like 1 1 n versus 1 1/2 n/2 or n thirds, mm-hmm. or stuff like this.
Yeah, that's a very good question, yeah. Maybe let's bring back the graphs. So there is sort of a physical implication of like which type of inflation you choose. Basically, like copying the sources basically means finding them out, which sort of implies that you expose their classicality. If you do like 1 1 n, I believe it basically corresponds to saying that the two of the sources can be arbitrary, not even non-signaling, I guess. But one has to be classical somehow, right? And so in that sense, if we could prove the non-locality of the Elegant Jot measurement, for instance, or other distributions with an inflation that doesn't duplicate, for instance, the alpha source, that would say something about what kind of physical models we can exclude for it. The impression I have is that, at least for the Elegant Jot measurement, the best is to really, and also for the shared random bit actually, is to increase like all of them. So keep something like n, and not like, so I've also tried like 1 n, when you keep one of the source with one copy and 2 of them you try to duplicate. and that, at least for the Lagrangian measurement, is not very competitive per. So like we should compare always inflation graphs that have the same number of parties, because that's like where the main complexity comes in, right? So between, you know, an inflation graph that has say 20 parties, in both cases you have 20 parties, but in one you have somehow like 1, 1, 20, I guess, more or less. Or no, 1, 1, 10, I guess. Versus 2, 3, 3. I believe the 2, 3, 3 would be is way better. Yeah. Actually, I haven't managed to prove anything. So like, actually, if we go to the plot at the end, with inflations of type 1, 1, n, I think I went all the way to 1, 1, 7. I don't even think it manages to rule out the point at 100% visibility. So that's how bad it is, I guess.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you. And maybe I can sneak in a second question. And this is about the fully corrective Frank Wolf.
Yeah.
So you say you have a full memory, but there is a sensitivity to an initial condition, no? An initial random point, if I remember correctly. So is it better to have less capacity but run the oracle several times? Or just run it once with a full memory until it converges to something? Does it make sense?
I think the second option made sense, but what is the first option that you're describing?
So maybe I misunderstood, but what I thought with this is that you choose a random initial point.
Yeah.
But if you're very unlucky with it, you can continue with the algorithm, and then you can gather lots and lots of points.
Yeah,
and then you just end up with a huge polytope, but it's not really converging.
Right.
Whereas if you cap the capacity and you just run the oracle 50 times with less capacity, maybe you're more lucky with the initial condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. That's a good question. Yeah. So one thing I think I can, I don't have a proof, but like my experience suggests that the initial point doesn't matter at all. That's also why I choose one and not like 10 or so, right? I just pick the old zero event somehow to start with. And I've tried to vary that a bit and it doesn't make a difference. I think the reason is that even like in simple examples, you can maybe convince, or we can maybe convince ourselves that it's just very fast. Like what would be a bad vertex here, right? It's not clear. Like if you pick a vertex that's very far away, then you will, I mean, it depends sort of the geometry, but even if it's far away, you will pick then a good potential direction and you will quickly come to the area of interest of the polytope. So the point is that like the picture to have in mind is that if you have like a big polytope that looks like some sort of tiling of a sphere, somehow Frank Wolf, no matter where you start on that sphere, will very quickly walk to like the interesting corner where your point is close.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I can see why. Okay, thank you very much.
But more generally, like the trade-off of like, yeah, how many points should you store in memory for what sort of improvement in convergence, that's what the Frank Wolf literature is about, right? So I guess, yeah, it depends, I suppose. But in my case, I had no reason, let's say, it wasn't so much the bottleneck so far, this fully corrective Frank Wolf, so that's why I keep it, because it's sort of the most powerful one, and then maybe at some point I have to change, but yeah, so far it was good. But yeah.
Thank you.
So there's another question online from Pedro.
Uh-huh.
Hi, Victor.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. My question is about, I remember in a previous discussion, you gave a very nice picture of the inflated network in terms of a cube,
yeah,
where the axes of the cube correspond to the latent variables. And then Nicolas Gizin, Antonia Girardin even published something using that idea for proofs of non-locality.
They came up with this visualization. I did not come up with this visualization. I was taught this visualization by them.
Oh, okay. So they were the ones who came up with that. I remember you mentioned this in a brief discussion we had with Ellie Speckens a while back ago.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But my question is like, can you use these algorithms and these new techniques to handle large linear programs in this picture to handle like maybe more analytical proofs of network non-locality in large networks, right? Could one do that in principle?
Isn't that what I'm doing? like, sorry, I'm not sure I understand. Like here I'm doing large linear programs. I'm using rational arithmetic. Sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, as long what I understood from your talk is that you're getting a large, very large network that we can't really handle with default techniques of linear programming.
Yes.
And then you're improving that using the various methods you mentioned. In that picture of the cube, mm-hmm. they had sort of geometric intuition. So I don't know where those two meet. Are those actually the same thing, or is there an actual difference that you can look for an analytical proof looking at those mismatches of squares inside the cube?
Mm-hmm.
With your techniques, so that's more of a to help for analytical proofs.
So by analytical, you mean a proof that you don't need a computer for, right?
Perhaps you need a computer for it, but you can make it such like a Fourier-Motzkin program. You need a computer for it, but it's totally analytical, right?
But this is what I do, right? Like what I do is totally analytical. Like you need a computer to run it, but it's like. Like the computer is like adding adding products of integers, right?
Okay, so you don't have no sort of error associated with the.
That's correct. Like the way specifically the way it's designed, I mean there are sort of two type of errors, I guess. The way it's designed is that, like the way the arithmetic is set up is that when it returns non-local, it means it's like analytically in that sense non-local. Sometimes it may say it's inconclusive, but actually there was like a tiny direction that could have been separating. So it might miss some non-local points, but when it says non-local, it means non-local. Of course, unless there is a mistake in the code, right? For that, yeah.
Right, of course.
But assuming the method is correct.
Perhaps I might have missed that.
Mm.
Okay.
I didn't go into a lot of details on that, so sorry, no, that's on me. I sort of left that out a bit because it's, yeah. But,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. But yeah, thanks anyway. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have two questions.
Yeah.
One is more a curiosity. When is an elegant measurement is something interesting? Where does it come from? What is that?
So it comes from Nicolas Gisin. No, it comes from, I guess it comes from, there are not that many examples of non-locality in a triangle. In particular, there are not so many of them that looks like this sort of genuine non-locality that is not based on the Bell scenario. So in that sense, any potentially non-local distribution can be interesting to just like have more. It's a bit like, you know, like for Bell non-locality, suppose we just had CHSH and we had not found any other inequality nor states that violate these inequalities, right? This is sort of where we're at more or less. Okay, I'm exaggerating a bit, but this is more or less where we're at with network non-locality in some sense. And so any example can be potentially interesting. Specifically, one thing which is nice with the elegant shot measurement is that it's believed to be noise. Like even if you have a noisy version of it, it's believed to be non-local. One thing I haven't said, which is maybe worth pointing out, is that here this lower bound where we found like analytical local models, the neural network tool that tries to discover local models. Agrees very well. Like it doesn't give like it's not analytical, right? It gives sort of, actually maybe I should have plotted it here, but like it gives like the error for each visibility. It gives like how close it managed to get using some sort of encoding of a local model, and like there's like a transition that you see. Basically, like here it gets close and then it gets not close, and like the transition point agrees very well with that. So it's so that's like further evidence that somehow the true visibility is like in that corner somehow, which means there is like all that line that is then non-local, which means that it's sort of more experimentally friendly because then you can, even if you have noisy singlets, you could in principle implement it. Whereas if you need like perfect singlets, there's no chance to ever do an experiment, right?
Okay.
And okay, so that's like specifically for the elegant drop measurement. And more generally, it's just an example that sort of drives the techniques. And I believe the techniques are generally useful and the topic is generally useful. And in that sense, the distribution serves as like a guiding problem, let's say. It's not the end of like, yeah.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Second question, it was more like a game. So you have this Frank-Wolf algorithm.
Yes.
But you sort of, you start from a line, when you go to a point of a bit bigger, bigger, until you, if you're really unlucky, you go to the same point of minus 1 point, no?
Ah, that's a good question.
Yeah, so at the end, if you go to a big enough polytope, can you start again the Frank-Wolf inside of the partial polytope from another vertex to get a Frank-Wolf resolution of the smaller one?
So, but
imagine when you have, first you have a line and you want to check where is it. Then you have a triangle and you want to check if the point is inside or outside.
Yes.
At some point you will have a super big polytope and you want to check if your point is inside or outside. Then you can use Frank-Wolf again on the smaller polytope.
Right.
But starting from another vertex, so
yes,
you get the same successor solution.
Yes, I see.
So you can do this iterative. Is this how it works?
So that's a very good question. There is one assumption in what you describe, which is not verified in this case, which is that even if you get unlucky, what I'm saying is that if you have n dimensions, so think of like 1,000 dimensions and you have 10 to the 9, say, extremal points, even if you're unlucky, you will store like 1,500 points at the end, and then you will get an answer, right? That's what happens.
Because it's that dimension, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
so that's nice.
Another question, is it something that works, or is any other Frank-Wolf connector something that instead of storing all the points and growing with this polytope, you just store the last point that you get, and you always
yes.
look at the just 2 points?
Yes, that's the vanilla Frank-Wolf, yes.
Is that ah,
the or Gilbert's algorithm, as it's called, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's definitely an algorithm you can use, but it's pretty bad.
Okay.
It's just, it doesn't converge very, it converges extremely slowly, basically. I can
okay.
show you some pictures later. There are some illustrations in the paper, like all the Frank-Wolf papers, when they start, they talk about the vanilla Frank-Wolf, then they show the same picture and of like why it's sort of slow in converging. Actually, I have it here, so I can show you here. Does it work? Oop. Yes, I had it open actually. The problem when you do the vanilla Frank-Wolf is that you have this sort of zigzagging effect. So basically you always store like these 2 points, then you check for like that to be a separating hyperplane, so you store, so you get rid of this one and you store, no wait, how does it work? Yeah, no, that's the thing, no, sorry, with the vanilla, I'm being silly. With the vanilla, you don't store actually, you also store like the iterate. Like most of the variants of Frank-Wolf, you don't just store the active set, you also store like the iterate, as you store like the explicit convex decomposition of the iterate in terms of the active set. Yeah, I forgot that. And so here, basically, you just have x1 and nothing else in memory, sort of, and you sort of go here, you see that there is this point which is better, so you go to x2, then you try this hyperplane, you find this point, x3, and then you zigzag, and so it's pretty bad for that. Oh, yeah, sorry. Do you want me to switch?
It's a question related to his first curiosity. But first, I just Googled the Frank-Wolf algorithm and saw it's something very old. I was all this time thinking it was Ellie's.
Yeah.
56.
Yeah, it's like from the 50s.
But there is something about the name and the and convex optimization, no?
Yeah.
I think.
No, it's just... when you were responding to his curiosity question, you said there are very few examples of non-locality in the triangle, including like genuine non-locality that doesn't come from Bell. What is your definition of genuine here? That
oh no, this is the hardest question.
Okay,
yeah, can we stop the recording?
Just because we're so confident, I thought you had some.
I think Maria here is more competent than me to answer this question. Or Ellie maybe, but okay, so let's say it's not a good definition that we can anchor on some precise math, but like an approximate definition would be, did you somehow appeal to Bell's non-locality to get an example? And in that sense, yeah. But that's very vague and hard to formalize, and I think that as far as I've seen, there are many papers with genuine non-locality in the title, and it always means something slightly different. So I'm not sure there are that many examples. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm not sure that there is sort of a widely accepted notion. So yeah, maybe when I said like, oh, we don't have that much like noise robust genuine non-locality, maybe just replace that with, we don't have that many examples of noise robust non-locality without the word genuine, maybe. Mm-hmm. Just to make it self-precise. But no, it's a good question, yeah.
Okay.
Good. So if there are no other questions, we thank the speaker.